This is Alan Chartok. Liz Kennedy is counsel at Demos, working on money in politics, voting rights, and corporate accountability. Demos is a public policy organization working to reduce both political and economic inequality, deploying original research, advocacy, litigation, and strategic communications to create the America, they say, that the people deserve. To that end, Liz Kennedy works to expand political participation and to prevent voter disenfranchisement by eliminating barriers to voting and empowering voting. Liz focuses on money in politics to work towards political equality and to fight corruption of democratic government. She develops policies, writes, and works with the partners across the country. In addition to appearing on television and being quoted in the media, Liz is the author or co-author of Bullies at the Ballot Box, Democracy at Stake, Protecting Democracy in the Super PAC Era, Citizens Actually United, Protecting the Freedom to Vote, and 10 Ways Citizens United Endangers Democracy. Prior to joining Demos, Liz was an attorney in the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at the NYU School of Law, working on issues of money in politics, democratic accountability, and corporate governance responses to Citizens United. Liz served as Deputy Director of Voter Protection for the 2008 Obama campaign in Ohio. She has represented unions in industrial bankruptcy and labor democracy cases and worked as a litigation associate at Cravath, Swain & Moore, LLP. Liz Kennedy's writings has appeared in The American Prospect, The National Civic Review, Human Rights, a journal of the American Bar Association, The Boston Herald, The Cleveland Plaindailer, The Los Angeles Daily News, The Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, The Hills Congress Blog, and The Huffington Post. Wow. Liz received her J.D. cum laude from NYU's School of Law and her B.A. from Smith College. Welcome, Liz Kennedy. I'm exhausted just from reading all about you.
Thank you for such a thorough introduction, Alan.
Well, we like to do it right. So let me start by asking a little bit, because our listeners always love to know who we're talking to, about you. What's the story? Who are you?
Sure. Well, I grew up in Brooklyn in New York City, the daughter of a union lawyer. So always really understanding power dynamics in our country. I worked as a student organizer, started registering voters before I was old enough to vote, because I think that we're all really responsible for setting the direction of our country and for letting our elected officials know when they are not putting our interests first. I think we're entitled to a better democracy than we currently have, and that the times that we're in essentially demand it.
How is Demos funded? We keep hearing George Soros. Is that right?
Well, Demos does receive funds from George Soros, as does lots of other fantastic groups. And we're funded by other foundations and by individuals who agree with our mission, which is to create an America where we all have an equal say in our democracy and an equal chance in our economy.
So here's the leading question, Liz. Are we going in the right direction or the wrong direction?
Well, there's tremendous upside potential, Alan, currently in our democratic rules, because as you know, we have unfortunately been in a period where we've seen the Supreme Court allowing really negative dynamics in our democratic governance. So, of course,
okay,
it's Shelby
right
County.
There. Liz, stop sure. right there. Why are they doing that?
Why are they doing that?
Yeah, you say they're leading us basically.
I can't.
Well, I could give some hints, but, you know, obviously it's a 5-4 Republican court. It's a little Congress,
sure.
I think. Yeah.
Sure. But I mean, regardless of speculating on the merits of the court, because, of course, you know, these 9 jurists represent a third co-equal branch of government, right? And so we pay a heck of a lot of understandably important attention to electing our president. And then a lot more attention should be spent, obviously, to paying attention to the dynamics of how our Congress gets elected. But then there's these other folks who, when Congress passes a law, the Supreme Court gets to decide right now if that law is or is not constitutional. And in a lot of ways, that's extraordinarily important. And they've done good work throughout the centuries. But they've certainly gotten it wrong when they said in Plessy v. Ferguson that separate but equal was constitutional.
Sure.
You know, that is not OK. And we think that in Citizens United, they really got it wrong again. And that actually the court for the last 40 years has really been setting the wrong direction in the way in which they've hobbled our ability to have common sense rules to prevent the domination of money over government. And so right now there's a case in front of them. They're hearing another challenge to a campaign finance law. And this would be another, the first time that the court would have struck down one of these laws should they choose to uphold the plaintiff's challenge to the rule. And it would be really, again, a step in the wrong direction. This is an attack on aggregate contribution limits, which set as the total ceiling for what one individual can contribute directly to candidates and parties and political committees at $123,000 per year. Now, that is over twice as much as the median American household income. So we're already talking about a system in which our politics and therefore our policies are dominated by a very small elite donor class, and we don't need our rules to get any looser in order to allow for further domination.
So let's go back, Liz, to the original question. You're an expert in Citizens United. I'd like to hear a little bit about what that case was and why everybody's so angry about it on the center-left side.
Great question, Alan. Citizens United was a decision in which the Supreme Court decided, as you say, on a 5-4 majority. They made several assumptions, and they allowed unlimited corporate spending into our elections, because what they said was that if you are engaging in independent spending, now you should consider that independent to be in quotes, mm-hmm. but if you are engaging in electoral spending that is outside of the direct contributions to candidates and political parties and political committees, the Supreme Court, Justice Kennedy, went ahead and said that that kind of independent spending cannot corrupt, cannot be corrupting of an elected official, because they said since it's quote unquote independent, it can't lead to quid pro quo corruption. Now, the problem is the rest of us understand that this kind of influence and access that these outside spenders through their million-dollar contributions, that this kind of spending engenders really a dependency in our elected officials. And our elected representatives are meant to be there to represent all of us, to respond to the interests and the preferences of their constituents, to respond to the needs of the public and our larger public policy as it sets the direction for our country. And yet Americans understand, 8 in 10 of them understand, large contributions are currently blocking our government from making the kind of progress on our pressing social issues that we need. So the court was just wrong in saying that access and influence are not corrupting, and in saying that independent spending would not lead to corruption. And they also then also said that there was no essential First Amendment difference between individual spending in politics and what kind of First Amendment protections individuals may be due versus corporations, which are, of course, legal creatures of the state, legal entities created through state law to serve certain economic interests. But the Supreme Court decided in Citizens United that corporations and unions were no different than individuals in terms of the First Amendment protection that their ability to spend money on speech was their due for that. So in that, we think they were very wrong. We think money is not speech.
I have never seen anything quite as inflammatory as this. What was it about the decision that made the Democrats so crazy?
Well, I think that there were several. There are several reasons. First of all, the Roberts Court was just really has now indicated in every case that they have taken dealing with campaign finance laws, they have struck down that law. But one of the big problems with Citizens United is that it really demonstrated this misunderstanding of the way that the campaign finance laws and our rules that protect our government from being overcome by money. I mean, remember, our current campaign finance system was put into place after Watergate, right? Watergate, which in addition to having these salacious details with the burglaries and all of these different things, was actually really a campaign finance scandal. It's actually a case where when you look back, and there's been a lot of great writing done recently about how much an ambassadorship cost and, you know, the way that the milk industry actually tried to manipulate milk prices and how everybody knew it through campaign finance donations. So it's a treasure trove of scandalous stories back then. Unfortunately, currently, what's scandalous is what's legal, because after Watergate, Congress responded by passing a set of campaign finance rules, and they set limits on contributions, but they also set limits on spending. They said, we need to really clean up our system of funding elections. It's not working. It's getting a government that is being bought and sold and that is being corrupted. They had in their, you know, certain people think about bags of cash, but the real problem is the powerful financial relationships that are formed and the way in which campaign finance dynamics allow people that have economic power to translate that into political power, and then they can work with the folks that they've helped achieve political power to help maintain their economic power. That is not a circle that works for average Americans. You know, Congress has never had a lower popularity rating, but it's really about confidence in government. And unfortunately, because the Supreme Court has said that the government has such a small space in which to regulate money, in which to help the rest of the citizens in this country have their voices heard by our elected officials, we're really circumscribed in what we're actually able to do. And I think that that has led to a lot of disengagement on the part of our citizenry who do believe that money equals access and influence and power, and who don't see themselves reflected in the public policy priorities that the government has been working on.
Now, in Citizens United, you saw obviously corporations being mentioned, but also labor unions. You mentioned that your father was a labor activist. What, in fact, was that doing there? Was that supposed to show us how even-handed they were being, since labor unions tend to be on the lefter side than the corporations?
That's entirely possible. I mean, what they were trying really to do is just to indicate that both of these were kind of associations. Of course, you know, unions actually are set up to be expressive associations where people join in order to vindicate and mitigate, you know, their rights, whereas corporations instead are, of course, creatures of the state that allow for people to join together in order to make profit. So there's really kind of a false equivalency there. But what's also really interesting, and I'm glad that you brought this back up, is that again, a place in which in Citizens United, the court really just misunderstood what was the way in which campaign finance works in the real world, is that the court assumed that all of the new money they allowed in would be disclosed. And so they said that corporations and unions would now be able to spend all of this money, but that shareholders and investors and the public would know who was behind all of this spending. Now, unions actually are required to disclose everything about their political spending. It's very, really quite transparent to the Department of Labor and various other mechanisms. Whereas, because all of this corporate spending was new, there are no such protections for shareholders. So there's a Senate briefing to talk about the need for and the appropriate role for the SEC to step into this breach and to issue a rule that would require publicly traded companies to disclose to their shareholders if and when they actually engage in political spending. And again, Justice Kennedy said that this spending would be disclosed, yet misunderstood entirely the regulatory regime in which he was releasing all of this new money, which was not up to the task. And that's why you saw, even though you saw millions of dollars going to super PACs, that money was at least disclosed. The money that went through C4s, 501c4s, all of these tax-exempt groups that then there was, you know, issues with how the IRS was able to judge which of these groups were properly social welfare groups and which of these groups, some with more political agendas, wanted to abuse this tax-exempt status in order, frankly, to be able to withhold the identities of their donors. California, you may have just saw, issued a huge fine. The California Fair Political Practices Commission doing a great job getting to the bottom of millions of dollars of dark money that were flooding their elections, and they were able to track back some of that and just issued a settlement. So the court was wrong in thinking that there would be disclosure, and we think that the court clearly, in the oral argument in the McCutcheon case, evidenced from the bench that they were unclear as to how any of this, should they strike the aggregate limits, how any of the base limits would be able to prevent the circumvention that would really lead to more corruption. And this is an instance where even Justice Scalia from the bench saying, campaign finance reform, it's so complicated, I can, you know, barely understand it. Yeah. If the court understands that they don't understand, they should kick it back down to a trial court and not continue to just blindly strike down these rules that we need to protect our democracy from the power of big money.
Well, you know, you sound very legalistic. You've graduated from one of the best law schools in the world, and, you know, you've had all of this experience. But to me, in my naive PhD sort of way, I just think we're screwed. I mean, this this group on the court, that 5-4 group led by a relatively young chief justice, is going to keep doing this stuff. And in my mind, I am so sorry to say it, they're bought and paid for by the interest that put them into office. So are you tilting at windmills, Sancho Panza?
I don't think that sinking into cynicism ever saved anybody.
Okay.
I think, you know, they conquer who believe they can. And the First Amendment is not a suicide pact for democratic government where merely because, you know, some people blinker themselves and stop at Congress shall make no law. Well, there are all sorts of laws where certain rights have to be balanced against other rights. The point here is that the court for 40 years has mistakenly equated money with speech and has mistakenly understood limitations on political spending.
Now, wait, Liz, why do you say mistakenly? Those guys know what they're doing. They didn't make a mistake. They're dancing with the one who brought them.
Well, that is an interesting point, and I will leave you to the speculation about the current makeup of the current court. But it actually was 40 years ago, Justice Brennan played a role in the Buckley v. Valeo decision, which was the initial seminal campaign finance case wherein they distinguished the burden that spending limits placed on First Amendment rights. And they said that the burden that contribution limits placed on First Amendment rights was slightly less. But still, they, I think, overweighted the burden of these rules. I think common sense rules for money and politics are necessary. And I think that we can get to a space because, I mean, 90% of Americans understand that there's too much money in politics. But the point isn't even the amount of the money that currently floods into our elections, which is pretty unbelievably high. But the problem is the tiny elite donor class that this affects, or rather that money in politics rules seek to make sure that government is not merely responsive to the needs of this smallest number of people. And so I do think that it's just so clearly the case that for politics and policy to reflect the will of the general public, we need to stop having these very small, elite, wealthy donor class have the only megaphone in which to affect the outcomes of our elections and then be screaming about their policy preferences on Capitol Hill. I think so many people understand the common sense nature of that proposition, that it will, the proposition that in a democracy, your right to representation and the impact of your voice should not be determined by the size of your wallet, that I think that, you know, there's also a huge movement growing in this country. We filed an amicus brief in the Supreme Court in the McCutcheon case urging the court to uphold the law because it is necessary to protect against corruption and the appearance of corruption. And we were joined by some of the nation's oldest and largest constituency groups, the NAACP, Greenpeace, Sierra Club, the Communication Workers of America, youth groups, small business groups, you know, Rock the Vote. There were tons at the AFT, all of these groups representing almost 9.5 million members coming together to say, Americans are outraged and they have had enough. And I think that we need to maintain this understanding. I think Citizens United was a dramatic moment where the American public woke up to understand that our elections were being dominated by big money and that this really, in a way that no longer made any sense to them.
Now, Liz, I hate to interrupt you, but if you stand on the corner here and ask the first 1,000 people who pass, what Citizens United, if you get a 2% correct answer, it's going to be a lot. I don't think Americans know it.
I saw a study, I think something like, it has like 60% name recognition amongst the
American
people.
I heard of that, yeah. But I don't know if they could tell you what it was, and I doubt.
They might not.
Yeah, and I doubt it, by the way, because I don't think 50% can name the vice president. So that's one of the problems. Okay, so you've properly criticized me for my cynicism, but you've also named all of these groups that have signed on the amicus brief. Nevertheless, my sense of it is that those five guys sitting up there aren't going to be any more receptive to that than they were, let's say, Bush versus Gore.
Well, it was, of course, a different group of five guys, right?
Who were, but it was still five guys.
Also a woman, right. Well, and one of them was a woman. But it was actually once Justice O'Connor left the court, actually, is where we lost
a
critical vote on campaign finance issues. Because, and may it be said also, Justice O'Connor was the last sitting justice who had run for office. And so who understood that this was, you know, a sphere that had to be separately understood. That there were important First Amendment issues on both sides of money and politics rules. So it was definitely a loss when her wisdom there came back. But, You know, I think that obviously Justice Kagan did a wonderful job in the McCutcheon oral argument suggesting that if the conservative majority was revisiting its earlier assumption that independent spending wasn't corrupting, that they should change that decision rather than strike down another law here in McCutcheon. I think this is a long game, Alan. I mean, it's not a game, first of all. Democracy is not a game. This is a struggle, and this is something that's going to continue for absolutely a period of time in the future. But, you know, I think in 10 years, we should be having a very different conversation about this.
Well, 10 years, I'll be 82, and I don't know that I want to wait around for that, but I did want to ask you, what's the way forward? Your outrage is apparent. I certainly respect it, but there's got to be a plan. What's the plan?
Absolutely. There is a plan. I think that the first thing we need to do is to educate the public. As you say, I think most people who have heard of Citizens United understand, even if they couldn't explain the legal issues, they can understand that it's something that has led to a larger dominance of government by the private concentrated economic power.
A loaded game.
There's something wrong in Denmark, you know. Yeah. And I think that's been fueling then this sense to want to know more about it and questioning how do we get out of this. There's a couple things. First of all, we could immediately, the SEC could have this rule that requires disclosure of corporate political spending. Because at the very least, and what used to be a completely non-controversial perspective that was understood to be like normatively right, is that transparency of money in our political system is a sine qua non of a functioning democracy. So, you know, those who are now against it used to be for it, and it's just ridiculous that we have had this explosion, $300 million in dark money in the 2012 elections, completely inappropriate and unnecessary. The SEC could pass a rule, and there are other disclosure bills that almost became law in 2010. One vote away from overcoming a filibuster, disclose would have been the law of the land. So first, we need disclosure for everything. Second of all, there are absolutely programs right now that would provide for citizen funding for elections, wherein there's a small donor requirement and then a public funding match. What this does is empower citizens to get involved at the $5 and $10 and $20 level, and a $100 check will be essentially the same, you know, worth the same to a candidate because it ends up being a 6-to-1 match as, you know, almost a $700 check. So this is something that New York City has a great experience with. And New York State has been on the verge of adopting this program. You know, big money interests such as developers in New York City are really fighting tooth and nail against this. But the Moreland Commission Against Public Corruption is holding a hearing, and they'll be coming out with a report wherein we absolutely hold they ought to recommend that New York State follow the good example of New York City and the good example of Connecticut and adopt a statewide citizen public funding program wherein we'll be able to get as much money back in saved tax revenues, essentially, if we didn't keep giving these billion-dollar tax breaks as this program would cost. So it's really, that would be the investment in democracy that we need. And then long-term, we need to keep talking with people so they understand that money does not equal speech and that common sense rules are the right thing to do to protect our democracy from being overrun by economic interests. And so I think that we need to just keep litigating in the courts, and we need to have brave state legislatures that pass important laws setting rules for the way in which money can influence politics and policy. And then, you know, we'll need to have a better version of the judiciary, essentially. Guido Calabrese on the Second Circuit understood in a decision he cited the widow's mite, that, you know, the largest amount from someone who has so little can mean more to them than, you know, the same amount from someone who has so much. Unfortunately, the Second Circuit actually just struck down contribution limits for independent spending here in New York State, rather they granted a preliminary injunction.
Saying what? Saying unlikely, considering this Supreme Court, that could pass muster.
Yes, unfortunately, you're right. What they said was because of the conclusions that the Supreme Court jumped to in Citizens United, and then because of a lower court which furthered that illogic unnecessarily, I would say, in a case called Speech Now, the Second Circuit overruled the lower court judge who had said that a preliminary injunction is a extreme remedy and that so close to the New York City mayoral race, there was no reason to upend the entire campaign finance system just weeks away from a key election, essentially saying that the plaintiffs had created this emergency themselves. This law has been on the books for a good long time, and had they wished to challenge it in a normal litigation process, they ought to have gone about it that way, not rush into court with this, you know, essentially the judge said made up emergency. But the Second Circuit overturned that and has now struck down limits on independent spending in the New York City race. And we will, I'm sure, get to be the benefit of lots more screaming attack ads as a result, which is really unfortunate. And we think the wrong direction. But we do think that there's a path forward to getting us into a better place. And the first step is understanding where we are and where we need to go.
So, first of all, let me take some exception to what you said about the match, the New York City match. I mean, considering what these guys are doing, how long is it before somebody brings an action and they say, no, you can't do a match either, that's also undemocratic?
Well, the Supreme Court has passed on the Arizona public financing program, and while they struck down triggered matching, they haven't struck down actual matching in terms of the design of the government program. So as long as it's not triggered off of anything that your opponent is spending, then the Supreme Court has upheld or hasn't struck down things like that, and that should not run afoul of their jurisprudence.
Liz, could you just bring us up to date on the business of triggering because of what your opponent has spent? Because there are some of these schemes, these public financing schemes, which say if your opponent spends more money, then you get more money. Are you telling us that that is likely to be illegal by our courts?
Sure. There was a case, actually, initially called McComish, but now it's the Arizona public financing case in 2011. There was a challenge to Arizona's public financing program, which did contain a triggered matching element, which meant you got a block grant. Essentially, there have been two different main public policy designs for public financing, and one of which is the one in New York City, which is this small donor empowerment, where if you give $10 and it's a 6-to-1 match, then the candidate actually gets $70, let's say. Whereas in Arizona, you would get just a block grant, like everybody who, when you got enough small donations, you qualified for the block grant, you would get an entire block grant of, let's say, $50,000, instead of having all of the disbursements being matched by your individual fundraising, you would just get a block grant. But then in order to take into account if you were running against somebody who had tremendously more resources than you, or if suddenly you were attacked by an outside spending group that came in and spent $100,000 against you, or even just $20,000 against you, and you still only had that $50,000 and had spent all of your money or what have you, then they would have allowed another, I think that another grant was capped at $17,500. So that was the idea, that it would be response funds. But the Supreme Court found that because response funds would be given to candidate A, candidate B, somebody would be chilled in spending in favor of candidate B because they knew that candidate A would get funds to respond. Now, what's bizarre about that is that the court has in the past found that more speech is always good. So, like, you know, you'd think actually if somebody could speak and then there'd be response and, you know, that they, frankly, could have upheld that on the basis that that would lead to more political speech and not be problematic. And, you know, if you throw your hat into the ring, you have to expect to be responded to, what have you. But they suggested that political spenders are so faint of heart that if they understood that by spending their own money, and remember, they're supposed to be in support, this is supposed to be political expression in support of candidate B, that they wouldn't have even done that if they knew candidate A would then get another $5,000 or what have you to respond.
Quite a stretch.
A little bit.
We're talking to Liz Kennedy, counsel at Demos, a public policy organization working to reduce both political and economic inequality. So let's talk about Bloomberg for a moment in New York City. One of the richest men in the world spent his money liberally to get himself elected. And no matter what anybody else spent, he was going to outspend them, no matter what the rules were, right?
Yes, it appears that way.
Yeah. So while some of these, and I use the word schemes, I don't mean it in a negative sense, public financing schemes are set up in a particular way, what Norman Adler used to call the golden rule, which was those who have the gold rules, does seem to be operative here.
Yes, I think clearly when you have a billionaire, the kind of the self-financing candidate is one where it becomes very problematic. There's no ability. The court has restrained our ability to adopt spending limits, no matter how much people might support them, to say, okay, you know, here everyone has this amount, now go out and have your ideas be in front of the voters in some kind of relatively...
Let me just stop you for a moment. It seems to me, if I'm a political party leader, you know, I've been around Albany for a long, long time, and I've watched the way this sort of thing works. When all else fails, go get yourself somebody with really deep pockets, and as a result of everything you're talking about, that becomes a very attractive candidate.
The
head of Gristides or the head of this or that, who can do that? So that's what
and
we're...
And in fact, we've seen so many, recently, so many individuals, who've kind of come in after careers spent amassing wealth and now have tried to come over into politics, whether in some of the Senate races in Connecticut or in California. So I think that we do see that. I think what we also see is that this really narrows the field. And this gets back to what I was saying. One of the biggest problems with our current campaign finance system, the current way in which we allow money to play this really big role in politics and policy, is that it distorts the voices and it distorts who gets to both actually run and win, right? 84% of Congress received more donations from the 1% of the 1% than they did from all of their small donors combined.
Mm.
And so Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy spoke, it was reported in the Huffington Post this a couple of months ago, but was talking about the 4 to 6 hours of fundraising he's required to do every day.
Mm.
And he is calling people who can drop, you know, who can make $1,000 contributions. So he's only calling people who make between $500,000 to $1 million, let's say. And what he said, and we quoted him in our brief, is that what this means is that the people who, he says, he's heard a lot more about carried interest on the phone in the call room than he does when he's just out, you know, on the streets of Connecticut. Because what with there being so many bankers, you hear a lot more about what the folks on the Gold Coast of Connecticut feel. And their concerns are very different from the mill workers in Thomaston, he says. And he says, you certainly have to check yourself.
He's been on the show many, many times. And
that's so great.
Well, no, we have a program called The Congressional Corner. And when he was a congressman, he was on every so often. I mean, a lot.
Sure.
And he was always very honest about the pain of having to go out and do this. But he won. And he won for Senate against a fabulously wealthy woman from the wrestling group. And yet he won. Which leads me to ask you this question, Liz Kennedy. Is there a silver lining here? In other words, I remember when Mario Cuomo ran against Lou Lehrman. He said, every time you see an ad on television, a light should go off in your head saying, he's trying to buy the election. I always thought that was magnificent. And I wonder whether there isn't a silver lining to all of this, that new strategies on those who don't have the money have to be developed, and that the onus of having a lot of money could actually hurt you.
Well, I mean, it certainly is not the case that it is always true that the person who has more money is going to win. But we actually, you know, but you do see that something like 95%, I think, of the races, it was the person with more money that wins. So, you know, first there's that issue. But the second issue really is that, again, it's not because it is entirely deterministic, right, that the person with more money wins or that he who spends the most will win. The real problem is that when these barriers to entry are so high, and when you know that to even run for office, you're going to have to raise $200,000, $2 million, you know, whatever it is that was the cost of the winning ticket in the last election, right? It's like you win and then you know that you immediately have to start raising that money again. And where do you raise that money from? It's like, wasn't it John Dillinger that when asked why he robs banks, he said, because that's where the money is?
Sure.
You know, so of course, there are many, many great, good government officials that are trying to serve in the public's interest. But when they are required to spend so much of their time hearing from and understanding they're going to have to go back to the same vanishingly small percentage of the elite donor class. Only 1,219 people right? 1,219 people were near hitting the aggregate contribution limits in the last cycle, and those are the ones that are being challenged in McCutcheon. And yet our research projects that if these aggregate contributions or limits are struck down, there will be another $1 billion pouring into our elections through 2020. And one of our amicus partners from the Working Families Organization put it, we risk having politics merely a disagreement amongst rich people.
I love it. What is your sense of the altruism of big donors on the other side, on your side, and what they're thinking about all of this? I mean, clearly, not everybody who has a lot of money, we know this, is a Republican. Some of them are Democrats. When you talk to those folks, they help to fund your organization. What are they telling you?
I mean, I think that a lot of people are just waking up to understand that in order for our country to be the place that it can be and that it should be, we need a Democratic government that is working a heck of a lot better than our current one. And I think that one thing that you can really point to with the current dysfunction and then with our real national kind of sense of the fact that our government is not responding to our needs right now. I think that it is absolutely bipartisan. It is across partisan lines that people think there's too much money in our politics, and that people think that there's too much corporate money and that it all should be disclosed and that there should really be common sense limits as well. So I think that when you get away from just the high-level partisan bickering, you can really see that people throughout the country on all sides of this agree. And so that's why you see small business people coming out and joining with labor to say, you know, this is not the way we should be making our decisions. We need to be a lot more responsible. And in order to be a lot more responsible, we need our elected officials to be a lot more responsive to us. You know, the Committee on Economic Development put out a poll that showed that something like 75% of business people referred to the campaign finance system as pay to play. You know, pay to play. And that's really utterly a corrupt system when you're paying in order to get some kind of government good or service or what have you. And so I think that responsible adult minds should prevail so that we can come together and start afresh with designing a system that allows for our legitimate political disagreements and First Amendment rights to express ourselves politically to be protected. And yet our interest in a responsive government that is not captured by concentrated private economic interests and not just a disagreement between rich people, you know, we deserve better. And so I think that we will continue to struggle together until we can bring that to pass.
Who are your heroes in the movement now?
That is a very good question. I mean, first and foremost, I will say Stephen Colbert has done more to educate the American public about some of the ridiculous elements of our campaign finance system. So anyone who's paying attention to that, I really...
A lot of people.
Admire. And I admire him using his, you know, taking that on. So I think that there's really, we just need a lot more attention being paid to these issues and the way that they connect to people. I mean, Reverend Barber, for example, the head of the North Carolina NAACP, was leading the Moral Monday demonstrations against so much of what the current North Carolina government, which, of course, was heavily funded by Art Pope. And then
who's Art Pope for our listeners?
Art Pope is a very, very wealthy man who is in North Carolina and set out to, he's kind of the North Carolina version of the Koch brothers, who has set out to spend a lot of money financing a lot of folks who then ended up getting elected to the North Carolina government. Art Pope was then appointed, I believe, director of budget, I believe it was. And, you know, as a result, I'm sure your listeners know that the last session in North Carolina, they passed laws attacking all sorts of issues, and particularly rolling back voting rights, getting rid of same-day registration, hobbling early voting, and in really an attempt to consolidate power. So that's what we should know when we think about these things that seem like rule changes and they seem really arcane, and the phrase campaign finance is enough to put anyone to sleep. And yet, if you understand that what this is about is power, and you understand that what this is about is our ability to make decisions that affect our own lives and that reflect our own needs and priorities, we're not that far apart in this country on a lot of important issues the need to respond to climate change, the need to get much better jobs and raise the minimum wage. But our political system isn't responding to the common sense of the mass electorate, and it's because of our campaign finance.
So you're rolling the ball uphill. Pop was a labor union guy. You've told us that. Would you be comfortable if you were on the winning side someday?
Yes.
Are you sure?
This is not Sisyphean.
So this is a horrible situation for the American people, the way you describe it. And you're right. It does come down to what the founding fathers may have thought, although if you read Beard on Democracy, maybe not. And it does seem that it keeps getting worse and worse and worse. So where's the optimism?
Because I think there are so many more this again. There's a lot of upside potential here, Alan. There are many more people, I think, paying attention. I think that Citizens United turned a lot of people around to understand that we have to do something. And so I think the important thing here is to be able to harness that understanding and that passion, really, that a lot of people feel about their own issues. And then they understand that money in politics is a key element in making sure that progress on their issues occurs. Thank you for shouting out the founding fathers and their opinions here. Of course, Professor Larry Lessig has been doing excellent work, building on things that Professor Teachout has done as well, tracking back to the founding fathers and to the documents around our country's founding to show what the original view of corruption really was. Mm. And in fact, his theory about dependence corruption shows that James Madison, for example, said that government should not be dependent on not the rich more than the poor. That essentially, if the government has to be dependent on us all and not on any one cohort of ours. Similarly, FDR said, government by organized money is just as dangerous as government by organized mob. We've had these moments before. The Constitution, of course, was amended to allow for direct election of senators after there was so many kind of Senate vote-buying scandals. Senator Clark from Montana back in the early 1900s was actually unseated from the Senate after having been found to have bought his Senate seat from the Montana legislature. That was a story that the Montana State Supreme Court cited in its attempt to uphold its law banning direct corporate spending in elections on the heels of Citizens United. But then the Supreme Court, unfortunately, summarily reversed the Supreme Court of Montana without even giving the sovereign state the right to present its own arguments about Montana, saying, hey, you may think that money doesn't lead to access and influence, on the federal level, but let us tell you about our experience in Montana. We absolutely have seen offices bought and sold. You know, we then passed a law to get rid of these contributions. And now you're saying because the law has worked so well that we haven't seen offices bought and sold in 100 years, now we have to get rid of the law? That doesn't make any sense. That was also basically the argument that the Supreme Court, the majority of the Supreme Court, bought in the Shelby County case, striking down Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act and rolling back the decades of protections for voters that were necessary to fight back against the kind of discrimination that had been practiced in the civil rights era, but which was unfortunately continuing to be practiced. And to tie this back to North Carolina, that's what we saw, why North Carolina was able to move forward. So the Supreme Court has been doing some bad things in the realm of democracy, but we believe that Americans are understanding enough about how we need to fight back that we ought to be able to, you know, we'll be around longer than this current Supreme Court majority, and we think that future generations of justices will look back on the idea that money is speech in the same way that we look back on the idea that separate is and equal, that separate but equal makes any sense at all.
You're a lawyer. Do you respect the court? I don't mean respect the individuals on the court. Do you respect the institution?
Absolutely. It's critical. It's critically important that our courts have integrity and that they...
You think this court has integrity? You think this court has integrity? The Supreme Court?
I think the court does. I think there are a lot of people that are trying to do lots of good things and some people that really don't understand the damage that some of their decisions are making. And I think that we need to express to the court the way in which they have gotten things wrong. I mean, even in Citizens United, Justice Kennedy wrote, if elected officials succumb to improper influences and surrender their best judgment, then surely there is cause for concern. So
and then voted with the and voted with the other four.
Because he clearly did not understand that the extent to which their campaign finance jurisprudence is really turning people off.
We're talking about one of the brightest men in America who frequently sides with the other side, or sometimes sides with the other side, but who goes along with those other four guys, and you're saying clearly didn't understand? I think he understood.
Well, the dissent in Citizens United referred to Citizens United, that decision, as full of glittering generalities. So if you read it, it just is very kind of a highfalutin ode towards some kind of platonic ideal of the First Amendment that does not map onto the actual world in which we live, which is the real environment in which we need to grapple with these real-world examples. Justice Kagan is excellent at making these points.
Does it make any sense to elect the Supreme Court?
No, I don't think so. I think that that can, you know, open more avenues for influence that can be even more problematic. But I do think that there is an important sense in which the Supreme Court should understand its decisions to, you know, play in the real world, to live in a real space, which is where the rest of us do. So in that way, I certainly wouldn't advocate for elections, but I think that understanding of accountability of, hey, we got this wrong. For example, in the there was a, you know, famously, the court, of course, protects free speech and doesn't require people to salute the flag. And that was as a result of a free speech case in West Virginia. But that case where they came down and said that these Jehovah's Witness children did not have to salute the flag, that came down only a few years after the Supreme Court had actually upheld a law saying the Jehovah's Witness children had to salute the flag. So sometimes the court just understands that it gets things wrong. Judge Posner, of course, on the Seventh Circuit, famously in the last few weeks, has been much ado has been made of his seeming suggestion that he got his own decision wrong upholding the voter ID law, saying, I didn't realize that these were actually being used to burden people's voting rights. It seemed fine at the time, basically.
Unfortunately, yeah. He's not on the Supreme Court. He's on the Seventh Circuit.
Yes, of course, but he's very, you know, it's just judges can recognize that they are wrong about things. And so we can wait for them to get that, and we can wait until more and more judges understand this the right way.
Well, you see, I am, as you said earlier in the program, and you're absolutely right, I am far more cynical than you are, you know, about that. I think these guys were appointed because they knew they were vetted, they knew who they were, they knew what they were going to do, and they've done it. And, you know, so that's it. But I'm fascinated by something else you said earlier, and that is the Colbert thing. We have watched in this country huge changes in things like gay rights. In which, you know, the thought of gays getting married, you know, 20 years ago, even, you know, 10 years ago, was impossible. And now all of a sudden, whoosh, you know, Americans, in my opinion, come to their senses. Or immigration. You got Lou Dobbs out there on the television yelling and screaming, get them, they're going to get us, and becoming a popular sort of right-wing hero. And then, boom, we have a presidential election and everybody takes a look at those results, and including the Republicans, says, uh-oh. So you may be right. I'm trying to subscribe to your brand of optimism and to say maybe things, you know, when you get a guy like, and who are the agents of change? Well, we know that from some studies that 50% of the kids are saying they get all, not some, but all their news from The Daily Show. That's extraordinary. And Daily and, you know, these guys are joined at the hip. So maybe you're right. Maybe that's the way it has to happen.
It's interesting. I mean, I do think that it's very important what, you know, cultural cues and being able to get this news out so that people understand it. Because otherwise, and so if it's through Colbert, then, you know, then that's certainly an avenue that should be open, and that is actually, given the absurdity, actually, of some of the constraints and some of the decisions and some of the, again, quote, logic that exist in this particular arena, it's ripe for Colbert to satirize, you know, the situations, super PACs, for example, and the idea that they're independent or what have you. But I think that there's others, you know, there are other really great stories in this realm. I think it's rich for the cultural reaping if other entertainment folks wanted to see some of these stories and to dramatize, again, some of the other scandals that haven't even been uncovered, or rather that haven't been brought to light. And I believe there was a John Grisham book about a Supreme Court case called Caperton v. Massey Cole, which was about a judicial election in which one of the parties, Massey Cole, spent millions of dollars to support the election of a candidate for the West Virginia Supreme Court, who then got on the bench and promptly reversed this like $50 million judgment that had been made against Massey Cole. Well, the plaintiff in that case sued, saying that they had been, you know, denied their equal justice, essentially, because how could they possibly have been expected to get a fair hearing if, in fact, hadn't received a fair hearing, right, in front of this judge whose election campaign had been bankrolled by the party, right?
We didn't get what we paid for.
Well, exactly. So, but what's interesting is that there, the Supreme Court, you know, and Scalia right alongside them, ruled for the plaintiff there and said that it wasn't fair that the plaintiff had the right to, because of the appearance of it being improper, you know, had the right to an impartial court or a court that also looked impartial, essentially. But the fact that they can understand how bad that looks in a courtroom and yet not understand how bad it looks in our Congress, when it's the exact same thing. If you're saying we should have a stricter environmental law, and then the person who's making the decision gets $3 million from a coal interest and say, oh, gee, I don't think we should have a stricter environmental law. You know, that's the kind of corruption that the American people are fighting back upon. And so the more we can tell stories like that, because I think people have this sense, and we just need to let them know that they're right and that there is a way forward, legislation and at the courts.
So coming out of this hour, and we don't have much time left, we have a basic disagreement, and you're not going to like what I have to say, but I think these are very bad people who constitute the majority up there. I don't think that they look at their grandchildren. And you mentioned the environment, and they are political animals who are playing, as you just indicated with this judge story, in a different way, or playing by, you know, you dance with the girl who brought you, and really have set the country back. Whether there is this growing recognition of the role of money, or whether people just become despondent and walk away and say, as my students always tell me, I say, what do your parents think of politicians? They always say, yeah, they're all a bunch of crooks. And that's despondency. That doesn't create a counter-revolution or a counteraction. It just means they live under this. Do you see where I'm going?
I do. I do see where you're going. And it's a real concern, Alan. I mean, I decry, you know, against cynicism, but I think that you are absolutely right that there is, and as I've been saying, this sense that things are not right. I think two things. A, you know, Justice Roberts has to, Chief Justice Roberts is in charge of bringing the court through this period with its institutional integrity intact. And, you know, people, court watchers have suggested that is one reason why he may have voted to uphold the Affordable Care Act. Because, of course, the court is not there as like a better, stronger, smarter legislature. They're not meant to be revisiting public policy decisions and, gee, they don't like it, they would have gone another way, so now they're going to be able to reshape our, you know, public policies in their own image. That is not the constitutional design. So to the extent that, you know, Justice Roberts, when he was on the bench in the oral argument, was asking questions that seemed to indicate perhaps he was trying to figure out a way to uphold much of the law but strike down a little bit, which, you know, is not exactly Solomonic, this splitting the baby. He really should just take an entire step back and recognize that we need these rules and that they don't really understand what will happen if these rules are removed, and it's not their space to determine that if they don't understand it. They should put it back to the trial court or wait to see in any event. But in terms of this overwhelming sense of a bunch of crooks, I absolutely agree that that is a huge problem. And in fact, the court has agreed with that in the past. The court, since the Buckley v. Valeo decision, has understood that the government has the right and the authority and, in fact, the need to pass these laws to protect against both actual corruption, but also the appearance of corruption. And as the court wrote in McConnell v. FEC, the decision in 2003, a mere 10 years ago, that upheld these important anti-solicitation bans, it held that if you take away Congress's authority to guard against the appearance of corruption, the cynical assumption that large donors call the tune will jeopardize the willingness of Americans to participate in our politics. That is what the Supreme Court decided a mere 10 years ago, again, when O'Connor was on the court, et cetera. But they should not turn their backs on that understanding, that kind of real-world understanding. That's exactly the kind of analysis they need to bring here. Justice Ginsburg, at oral argument, was saying, don't you think we need some kind of protection so that the little people feel like their voices matter at all? If the little people, and again, this is something that we said in our brief, we put forward research from Princeton professor Martin Gillens in a book called Affluence and Influence that showed that not only do the public policy preferences of the donor class differ entirely, very substantially, particularly on economic issues, from average Americans, but that government is actually more responsive to the needs of the 10% than the needs of the 90%, even when the preferences of the 10% differ from the preferences of the 90%. It's shocking. It shouldn't. It's not shocking. Everybody says, of course, it's not shocking. We're cynical. We're never shocked. But it is real research. And I think that that kind of real social science research, we need to be able to break through, and we need to have it prepared for a moment when there is a court who is willing, maybe Justice Roberts today in a little bit, and then maybe down the road, a court who's willing to revisit really our base understanding so that we can move forward in a better direction with our democracy.
We're out of time. We've been talking with Liz Kennedy, counsel at Demos. Liz, thank you so much for joining us. It's clear you know what you're talking about and that you've worked hard on this, and I urge you to keep going forward. I'm Alan Chartok.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.